I'm John Dennis. In a special edition of Guardian Weekly, we look at one of the most dramatic events in the history of Wall Street.
Bankers have gone mad with our money.
The collapse of Lehman Brothers, a 160-year-old investment bank, came on the same day as Bank of America's $50 billion takeover of Merrill Lynch. And confidence in the global financial services industry has collapsed in the sector's worst crisis since the Great Depression.
I see this as a new financial world on the verge of a complete reorganisation.
Lehman Brothers was the fourth largest investment bank in the US. It filed for bankruptcy protection on Monday after frantic weekend negotiations to find a rescue deal fell apart. Merrill Lynch was taken over by Bank of America for $50 billion in an effort to protect itself from the same fate as Lehman Brothers. John McFall is chairman of the Treasury Select Committee in the House of Commons.
I don't think we've seen a weekend like it since the late 1920s. Here we have Lehman's 158-year-old bank being followed by Merrill Lynch. And I see this as a new financial world on the verge of a complete reorganisation.
What can the authorities do to stop other banks going the same way as Lehman Brothers?
Well, I think that there will be more bank failures, but it is for the authorities to have a steady hand and head at the moment to see this through and to do it in an orderly way. But what this has proved is that the market is dysfunctional. Indeed, there is no market. It's a falling back on the state, as evidenced by the Fed with the intervention with Bear Stearns and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And really, if we're going to have a market and a free market, then we must allow firms to go out of business and to do so in an orderly way, not in this disorderly and panic-driven way that we've seen lately. There are going to be other banks that are going to fall, but at the moment, we don't know where the next crisis is coming from, and I would describe it as financial landmine territory.
Do you think it's the end now of the light regulatory touch that has been the hallmark of the government for the last sort of 20 years?
Well, I think what we've seen globally is not light touch regulation, but soft touch regulation. And we've seen the best and the brightest in the financial world investing in products in which they do not understand and selling them to consumers who do not understand these products as well. So it's a circle of ignorance, and that circle of ignorance has led to this catastrophic situation.
The Guardian's business editor is Deborah Hargreaves.
More worrying is what's happening in the banking market, where banks are refusing to sell to each other. They're refusing to lend any money. Overnight lending rates in the banking sector have gone right up. Central banks have pumped in billions of dollars worth of money today. Over $210 billion worth of money has gone into the financial system, and yet no one wants to lend at all. That will have an eventual knock-on effect on our mortgages and our borrowing, because the rate will go back up again.
And other banks are now at risk, presumably. We've seen HBOS shares drop 40%. One in every five pennies saved in the UK is with HBOS. It can't go bust, can it?
It's unthinkable that the government would allow HBOS to go bust. I mean, it is a massive bank. It's Britain's biggest mortgage lender. And as you say, lots of people have got savings with it. Also, a lot of private investors own HBOS shares, and they won't have been doing very well from the slump in the shares over the past 2 days. At one point, lost over 40% of its value in shares, which is an extraordinary move for a big company like HBOS. Those shares have recovered a little bit now, but it's still down about 17%. HBOS has insisted that it's financially solvent, it has a good capital base, and it has plenty of money to be getting on with. But at the moment, confidence is everything in these markets. As soon as confidence starts to evaporate, share prices can take a huge knocking. But as I say, I don't think the government would at all allow one of the high street lenders to go out of business.
We've seen inflation rise to a 16-year high. The governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, has had to explain why in a letter to the Chancellor. But oil prices are coming down, so might we see a further cut in interest rates in the UK?
That's what everyone's now hoping. Inflation is expected to rise for the rest of this year up to probably about 5%. But as you say, oil prices have come right down again. They're just around $90 a barrel at the moment. And don't forget, in July, their high point was $147 a barrel. So they've come back a huge amount in the past couple of months. So I think inflation is a short-term problem, and by next year we won't be worrying about inflation at all. We'll be worrying about recession, and it makes it more likely that the Bank of England will cut interest rates, and maybe as soon as next month, which will be in a couple of weeks' time.
Things are happening so fast, Deborah, it's slightly hard to make long-term predictions of any sort. But what sort of changes might now be demanded in the way that our financial institutions are run?
I think there's going to have to be a big clampdown on banking regulation. I think banks are going to have to go back to their knitting. They're going to have to stop doing some of the very risky things they were doing before that took us into this big slump. It's an astonishing time for financial markets. On Monday, for example, seeing a big investment bank like Lehman Brothers go out of business and Merrill Lynch taken over in a $50 billion deal on the same day is an extraordinary thing to happen. I mean, these are not normal times. Even yesterday, we've got AIG, which was until recently the world's largest insurer and which is behind lots of insurance contracts all over the world. It looks like it's going to be bailed out by the Fed. Things are moving very fast and it's very difficult to predict what will happen next. But there will be a tightening up of regulation as a result of this. And there needs to be, because bankers have gone mad with our money and they have indulged in a lot of reckless lending and a lot of very risky investments.
Paola Sabaki is Research Director of International Economics at the Chatham House think tank.
Broadly speaking, I remain optimistic. I don't see yet the signs of a big recession like the 1930s. Again, you know, if you look at the events of the last, I would say, months, we got through a shock on the commodity market. We got through a shock in terms of food prices. We got through a number of, I would say, problems with financial and banking institutions. And yet we are still here discussing whether we are in recession or not. And I think this is a very important point to bear in mind. Compared to the 1930s, where the world was much more divided, where the dividing line between, I would say, developed countries and poor countries was much wider, I think now we are in a situation where, at the very least, there is the willingness to cooperate at the international level. And I think as soon as the Lehman Brothers collapsed, then the Bank of England and the ECB immediately agreed to inject liquidity in the system. So again, this kind of, I would say, cooperation, maybe it's not, I'm sure, with some formal coordination as well, it's very important. And I think at the basis of it is the understanding that the financial system, international financial system, is so integrated that, you know, nobody can afford to see any failure and everybody's happy to cooperate.
Dr. Paola Sabaki. Well, what should the government be doing? The Guardian's Hélène Mulholland posed that question to Vince Cable, the Treasury spokesman for the Liberal Democrats, at their party conference in Bournemouth.
Two crucial things. One of them was the need to firmly embed the system of depositor protection in law. The government has made it very clear that depositors will be fully protected in the UK if there is a collapse of an institution, which is why we haven't had any further runs on the bank since Northern Rock. But the arrangements and the limits have not been firmly secured. There is still doubt as to how the funding mechanism, for example, for deposit protection, and we need to get this into law very quickly. And I think the second is defining the circumstances and how failing banks are taking over. And that's, again, the government's had consultation about that, and that will be part of the new legislation when it comes. But another British bank could go, just as Lehman has done, and we need to be very clear about who is responsible for the decision-making so that we don't have the fiasco we had with Northern Rock, and that the rules of the game are very clearly specified.
Do you think this is the beginning of the end of capitalism as we've known it?
No, I don't think that. I mean, throughout the history of the Western world, we've had financial crises, and I think one of the things which decision makers forgot is they got into this, you know, hubristic frame of mind who believe that this time everything was different and that you can have a boom going on forever and you can gamble and you're always going to win. I mean, that kind of stupidity happens in all economic cycles and particularly in financial markets. No, I mean, this kind of shock, you know, if you can go back through the 19th century, the early 20th century, you can go back to the 18th century and we've had phenomena of this kind. People never seem to learn. What is much more dangerous, of course, is that markets are now much more interconnected, you know, because of internet systems and telecommunications, and they're therefore much bigger, and therefore when things go wrong, you know, more finance is sucked into the system, there are more casualties, but there's also more potential for benefit when the thing goes well. So this isn't the final crisis of capitalism by any means. It could do a lot of damage, but there will be a recovery. But it is important we learn some lessons.
Vince Cable. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in this week's edition of Guardian Weekly, the Cerne Abbas giant repaired. But first, Robert Mugabe and Morgan Tsvangirai have agreed to share power in Zimbabwe. Mugabe is still president, he controls the army, whereas Tsvangirai becomes prime minister. Tsvangirai said it required painful compromises after 8 years of struggle for democracy, but it also represented the return of hope for freedom from fear, poverty, hunger and oppression. Chris McGreal is in Harare for The Guardian. He explained how the South African president, Thabo Mbeki, persuaded Mugabe and Tsvangirai that this deal was their best option.
The economic realities were really bearing in on Robert Mugabe. This country is facing 20% inflation, which may actually be as high as 50%. They can hardly afford to feed and pay the army, let alone the rest of the civil service. And I think that for Mugabe, at least, he needs some kind of access to the foreign financing that's necessary to revive this economy. For Tsvangirai, the people around him say that whilst he'd had to make quite considerable concessions, there was a very important factor in the back of his mind. He felt that if he held out any longer, the hardliners around Mugabe would actually take over completely, and that would preclude any possibility of an agreement, probably for a year or two, and then Zimbabwe would seriously risk becoming a failed state, and it would be that much harder to revive things. Tsvangirai felt that what was on the table was, you know, a workable solution, something that offered them the mechanisms by which to ease Mugabe out of power and to restore democratic rule here.
And what about reviving the economy? Because, I mean, it's quite a task, as you've said. Foreign aid can now be released to Zimbabwe, and Morgan Tsvangirai now has the task of getting food to the millions of people on the verge of starvation.
Yes, I mean, there are various things at work here. In the terms of the food situation, the World Food Programme and others will bring in quite large amounts of food. The problem has been up until now that the Mugabe's government has refused to allow NGOs on the ground to distribute it, in part because the government likes to keep control of that as a means of keeping control of the people. Now, Tsvangirai says he'll end that immediately and just put in place all the mechanisms necessary and allow the NGOs to work to get food to the people. The second part of that is to revive the agricultural industry, which has been decimated, not only by the redistribution of formerly white-owned farms, but by the collapse of communal farms along with the economy, so that this country, which used to export food, is barely able to feed itself. Now, there's lots of issues around the former white-owned farms, but there's a feeling that the communal farms can be got off the ground again pretty quickly. Those farmers are skilled, they know what they're doing, they just need the assistance to get the irrigation working again, to get the seeds, and so the country can get back to producing, you know, a significant amount of food again within a season, even if it can't produce everything it needs. As for the foreign aid, that's rather more complicated. There's £1 billion worth of money been earmarked by the Europeans and the Americans, but they want to see who's really in charge of this new government, whether it's China Tsvangirai or whether Mugabe remains dominant. If Mugabe does, then they say no money. If Tsvangirai can demonstrate that he has real authority, then they'll start releasing that money. And an early test of that will be who is the finance minister of the country, is it a member of Tsvangirai's party, and crucially, whether the governor of the central bank, Gideon Gono, who has been at the center of many of the economic problems, including the hyperinflation by printing vast amounts of money, whether he is removed from office very swiftly.
Mugabe retains the army. The Movement for Democratic Change controls the police. Elections are due to be held in a couple of years' time. Is there now a realistic prospect of those elections being free and fair?
Yes, I think if Tsvangirai genuinely does control the police, and that would require the removal of the present police commissioner, who had said before the last election he would never recognise or salute Tsvangirai as president, and who's used the police force as a political weapon against the opposition and just the ordinary voting population. If the police are essentially depoliticised and come under proper control and are basically do their job, I think that yes, then a free election can be held. There have been plenty of elections, and most people in this country know how to conduct a proper election. It was just that they weren't able to do so because of the terror that was unleashed against them and the role of the police in that. If the police were an independent force doing their job, I think that would do a lot to reassure people that they could vote as they wanted. So I think that there's a real prospect that in a couple of years or so, yes, there would be a very open and clean election.
Thabo Mbeki brokered this deal in Zimbabwe. How will it affect his own political fortunes in South Africa?
Well, I think there was a time when it would have done a lot to revive his reputation, which had been battered over a number of years, partly by his rather peculiar stance on AIDS and his willingness to stand by whilst hundreds of thousands of his own countrymen died from the disease, and his particular brand of Machiavellian politics in South Africa. However, I think it's probably come too late to save his reputation domestically anyway. He's fighting for his political life this very week after a high court ruled last week that essentially Mbeki had been at the centre of a criminal conspiracy to indict his rival, Jacob Zuma, to prevent him from taking over the ANC. Zuma was charged with corruption, but those charges, whether they were valid charges or not, were motivated by political considerations, according to the judge. Now, Mbeki's own party, now led by Jacob Zuma, is debating whether to remove him from office very swiftly. So whilst in many ways I think he feels vindicated by this result in Zimbabwe, that his policy of quiet diplomacy, which was derided at home and abroad for failing to deliver, has in the end delivered, I think that it will be overshadowed by his other political problems.
Chris McGreal in Harare. On a hillside in Dorset, in southern England, the Cerne Abbas giant stands there with a club, naked as the day he was born. He's been there for hundreds of years. Steve Morris reports for The Guardian on efforts to restore his pride.
Rob, we're walking up Giant Hill at the moment. What are we going to see when we get out of these trees?
Well, we're walking through this little patch of woodland, and in any second now we're going to pop out onto the hill. And on a very steep hill above the village of Cerne Abbas here in Dorset, we're going to see the chalk figure of the Cerne Abbas giant.
Tell me a bit about the history of this figure, or what we know of the history.
Well, the history of the giant itself actually remains a mystery in the fact that nobody really knows. That's part of the beauty of the giant and the myth and the legend of him, that we're not really sure if he is thousands of years old or hundreds of years old. There's all sorts of different theories, and lots of people have different ideas of his original origin.
Such as?
Well, he could be a Roman figure. He could be a symbol of Hercules, or he could be a cartoon character of Oliver Cromwell. The hill's getting a bit steep here now.
It is, isn't it? A bit puffy at the moment. For the people who don't know this figure, he's quite a familiar figure in the countryside, but just explain what he looks like.
Well, as you say, yeah, he's quite familiar to the Dorset folk, quite an icon of the county. Large chalk figure, naked, holding a club in one hand and with another arm reaching out. There's some theories about what he might have been holding in his left hand, whether it was a lion's head or a loincloth or a cloak. All sorts of different theories and ideas about what the left hand is doing.
But you're missing out the most distinctive characteristic of this figure.
Yes, yeah, he is probably his most famous for his large phallus, shall we say.
So, Rob, what are we doing here today? Why are we climbing up this now very steep hill?
Well, we're puffing our way up the hill to see the team of National Trust wardens and volunteers who are carrying out the rechalking of the St Albert Giant. After about 7 years, the chalk has degraded and lost its colour, and lots of grass and moss and things has grown up because of the wet summers. So we made the decision to dig out all the old chalk, take away the old dirty stuff, bring in new fresh chalk, and give the giant a good old spruce up and get him back looking at his best again.
Could you first just give me your name again, please?
It's Brian Brown.
Mr. Brown, you're working on a very delicate part of the body here. Yes. I suppose this is the
testicle.
The left testicle, yes, indeed. What are you doing exactly to this left testicle, if I can...
All we're doing is cutting the edge, which has grown over the grass, and then removing a layer of chalk, about an inch or 2 inches, to take away any weeds that have actually rooted themselves into the chalk. And after that, we will then put in new chalk, tamp it down, and hopefully have a nice white rim to the testicle.
And what does this giant mean to you as a local person?
Just a sort of a great symbol, I suppose, really, of this part of Dorset.
It's quite a privilege to work on this very famous part of a very famous figure, I suppose.
Yes, yes. I mean, I hope we don't remove too much.
Stephen Morris reporting. Now, before we sign off this week, it's just time for me to tell you about the latest print edition of Guardian Weekly. Some of the highlights you can read this week: George Bush has taken the unusual step of giving US Special Forces carte blanche to mount counter-terrorism operations inside Pakistan, supposedly one of America's allies in the war on terror. Pakistan is riled. It says it will defend its sovereignty at all cost. Republican running mate Sarah Palin edges away from her outmoded views on climate change. She concedes the problem might be man-made. Palin gave a series of TV interviews which critics say exposed gaps in her grasp of foreign policy. And in landlocked Bolivia, sailors who have never been to sea pine for open waters. This week's edition of our podcast, Guardian Weekly, was produced by Ian Chambers. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.